The title, if you've been here all summer for the series, is Christ and Culture, Living Faithfully in the World. And as I've looked at the topics and gotten to hear a couple of them, the recordings, you know, each week has been taking up some aspect of the challenges that face us in our culture, in our own lives. And as we dive into this one, a couple things to say. First, when I read as the presenter, Faith and Family in a Digital Age, I'm not sure what you think that means. I wasn't sure what I thought that means. So by the end of this, you'll see what I ultimately thought that might mean. But want to point your attention to a couple different directions. One thing I'm going to mention, or that I used, is very helpful in preparing this, was a book by a guy named Tim Challies, who's a pastor and blogger. The book's called The Next Story, Life and Faith After the Digital Explosion. I know from experience that the Downtown Public Library has one copy, and it should be back there by about Wednesday. So if you're interested, that is there. I'm also going to make mention of a online sort of a transcript of a talk that Neil Postman gave called Five Things We Need to Know About Technological Change. And Neil Postman, you may remember from Amusing Ourselves to Death and other books he's written. And then third resource, I thought the Bible was really helpful, and you probably have a copy of that as well. Now, here's what this lecture isn't. It's not a list of do's and don'ts or, quote, Christian rules from the Internet. And it's not a list of statistics on how screens affect our brains or the rate of, Internet pornography use. It's not even really a battle plan for redeeming the digital world for Christ. Instead, I kind of want to get at just one simple question. Why is the digital world such a powerful force in our lives? Why is it so appealing to us? Why does it draw us in like it does? How is it so potentially domineering even in our lives that we use terms like screen addiction and talk about the need to take a vacation away from our devices? How is it that otherwise responsible human beings, even here in Columbia, myself included, need to be reminded, wait to text? Like, what is it about the world that's grabbed us like that? Okay, so first a little bit of context. We're in a culture, as you know, in transition into however you want to define the digital world. Most of us in this room, well, maybe that's not true, at least half of us, if not more, did not grow up in a digital world. And you like me, can probably think back to the markers in your life that saw technological change. I mean, I can remember probably fourth or fifth grade, my family was early adopters of personal computers. So we had this little computer that you plug into your TV that's about as powerful as like somebody's, wristwatch now. And I don't mean an iWatch. You know, it couldn't do anything. And my dad and I spent hours on a graphics program making a picture of a turtle. And you did that by plotting in where you're on the screen you wanted a dot for each and every dot. And then, because it took so long you wanted to save it, you press record on a tape deck that recorded the information so that you could play it back. And I've lost some of you because you're like, what's a tape deck? I don't even know what that is to begin with. When I was in college, the year after I graduated, I was in school in the mid-90s. The year after I graduated was the first year at my college, or really anywhere, that students were given an email address. And can you imagine sort of life without email now? I remember when we bought our first cell phone just to have, ostensibly, well, if you're on the road, I really just thought it was sort of cool. But we did. When I was growing up, it was a car phone. And it took an entire vehicle to make a telephone work away from the one that was plugged in your home. So what's interesting, though, is if you're under, I mean, this is kind of an arbitrary age, 20, 25, you have grown up, I've heard the term, as a digital native. Like, this is now your native land. You don't remember a time when you or your parents didn't have a cell phone. You don't remember that there was a time when people were not immediately accessible, when you couldn't just call somebody wherever they were. They used to have telephones that were tied to a place called your home. And if you were in high school and you finally got up the courage to call a girl and ask her on a date, you had to like sneak around so that not everybody else in your family, because it was just so embarrassing. Like, that's not the way we live anymore. You don't remember a time when the world wasn't mediated to you through a screen. And as My wife pointed about one of the challenges for us as parents, and for anybody that's parenting kids in your home right now, is that you didn't grow up as a digital native, and so we're trying to make it up as we go along. We're on kind of the first front of parents that didn't grow up in a certain kind of world digitally that are now trying to figure out how to help our children grow up in a world that is digital. Okay, so transition in our culture. There's become, as you know, we see it and feel it, but this incredible elevation of the digital world. And you know, I think when that was first talked about, a digital age or digital world, it was sort of like thought of as this imaginary world because it's not tangible. But if you think about it, the digital world really exists. Yes, you can't see it. Yes, it's called a cloud. But when you or your kids are texting friends somewhere else and carrying on conversation and relationships, there's a real world that's happening there. It affects us in so many different ways. I mentioned this Neil Postman lecture, 5 things we need to know about technological change. And I want to mention 3 of those just as kind of a context for us as we think about this idea of digital world. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about how do we specifically think as Christians from what the Bible says about what the digital age taps into. But first, 3 of these points from his lecture. Number 3 in his lecture, he said this, that embedded in every technology is one or more powerful ideas not obvious on the surface. In other words, we get something like a phone, and we think it's just a phone, and it helps us talk to other people, which it certainly does. But he says every technological advance has things that come trailing behind it that we can't even foresee now, ways it's going to change our world, ways it's going to change our life. Take the phone for a minute. You know, again, your phone used to be rooted to a home, and it used to be something that you chose to answer or not. And it used to be something you hoped you could get a hold of somebody, and if not, you left a message on their answering machine once those came around. But now we live in a world where we are immediately accessible all the time. And even if you turn off your cell phone, people are frustrated that you're not answering their call because they expect you to be immediately available all the time. We're the first generation in history that grew up that way, except for people that grew up in towns so small you could just shout across the street. You know, anybody, any place of any size, that's a new and revolutionary way to live. So he says that embedded in technology, one or more powerful ideas not obvious on the surface. Technology changes the way we see the world, often without us realizing it. Here's a quote from the lecture. Perhaps you are familiar with the old adage that says, to a man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. We may extend the truism. To a person with a pencil, everything looks like a sentence. To a person with a TV camera, everything looks like an image. To a person with a computer, everything looks like data. That's changing the way we see the world. He goes on and says, there's embedded in every technology an epistemological, political, or social prejudice. Sometimes that bias is greatly to our advantage. Sometimes it's not. The printing press annihilated the oral tradition. Telegraphy annihilated space. Television has humiliated the word. And the computer perhaps will degrade community life and so on. So that point is simply that everything in ways we might not even expect, we can't be naive because technology changes things in ways we would not foresee. Point 4 in his lecture was technological change is not additive, it's ecological. In other words, when there's a technological change, especially in the digital world, it doesn't just add something to your life. It's like now it's my life plus a cell phone. It's technology comes in such a way that it invades and changes everything about our life. He uses the example, when you have a glass of water, if you put a drop of red dye into the water, you don't now have a glass of water plus a drop of red dye sort of hovering there somewhere. What does it do? It permeates the whole glass of water. He says technological change is ecological like that. It permeates everything. Here's a couple examples he gives. He talks about with the advent of TV in America. America was no longer America plus the TV. So TV gave coloration to every political campaign, every home, every school. Okay, think for a minute when back in the days when you used to have, this will sound strange to some of yours, there's a time when you could only watch a TV show when it actually came on. There was like this coming on event that happened. You had to be positioned in front of your TV. You couldn't record it. So families, if there was a show they liked, they would rearrange their schedule in order that everybody would be in front of the TV at the same time. And maybe that would happen during dinner time. And so maybe sometimes families would take their food into the living room and watch TV together. Or, and this was society at its crassest and closest to complete collapse, there was the creation of the TV dinner. And you could heat that up on your little Swanson thing and put it right in front of you. And let's just think about the way that changed things for a minute. It's no longer that we have a TV that we watch sometimes. But TV now has changed what human beings have done for eons, which is to often sit in a room that was dedicated somehow to food across from each other having conversations. So it's not just a TV, it changed the schedule and life pattern of whole families. The technological change is not additive, it's ecological. Another way he puts this is that media tend to become mythic. Okay, and when he says this, he's quoting into the thought of Roland Barthes, a literary critic. And he says that we have the tendency to think that technological creations are God-given, that they're a part of the natural order of things. And he said, Neil Postman said when he would teach students, he'd ask them, and it would just completely throw people off, like, who created the alphabet? And they'd look at him like the alphabet. It's sort of like, who created the trees in the sky? Like, it's always been there. It's just a part of existence. And he said, technology tends to have that effect on us. Your children are going to grow up thinking, what do you mean who invented the internet? Al Gore. No, yeah, like, who invented the internet's always been, it's just always, it's like, who invented the sky? It's just been there. Because technology and media in particular tends to become mythic. In other words, you can't imagine life without this. And if you can't imagine life without this, or you've grown up with it always, you can't really get your hands around how has this changed the fabric of life? How is this affecting my life and dictating ways that I live that I'm not even consciously aware of? Okay, so these are some things he threw out about what technology does around us. But let's go back to our original question. You know, why is it that digital technology, the digital world, functions this way in our lives? Why is it so very powerful? Well, here's something of an answer. The digital world, or maybe a better way to say it, our digital experience, taps into and interacts with some of the most fundamental aspects of who we are as human beings made in God's image. The power of the digital world is connected to how closely it maps onto our fundamental wiring as human beings. Let me try to point out just four areas for us. The digital age taps into four areas of who we are, essentially, the way we are created in God's image. First, our drive to do. Secondly, our drive to rest. Thirdly, our drive to know. And fourth, our drive to know and be known by others. And to dive into this and I think see the allure and the draw and power of the digital world is really then to look, as we come to the Bible, to think about some very basic passages that you are likely very familiar with, and yet to see how they apply to this kind of transformative experience we have of living now in a digital world. So the first thing is our drive to do. The power of the digital world taps into that because we were created to do. We were created to work. We were created to be productive in good ways. And that existed before the fall. It's not as if after the fall of Adam and Eve, God, in some ancient manuscript of the Bible that we haven't found, in parentheses it says, and after he cursed him, then he gave them jobs, right? And then he created work. Now, work in the garden was a part of our experience that we were created for, because God himself is a worker. He created the world. And he calls us into partnership with him. The problem is after the fall, it's all broken. And our hearts to do it are broken, and our effectiveness in the world is broken. Genesis 1, this is called the cultural mandate, says this in verse 28. God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. And maybe here's the further point. Creating technology is an outgrowth of that calling. So in a fallen world, when God tells us to go and to raise crops to feed your family, we invent the plow. And maybe we would have invented the plow if the world had not fallen. But now certainly we have insecticides that maybe we wouldn't have needed then. But to do work means we're looking for ways to do that work well. And that's simply, that's what's behind the simple progress of technology. As we see problems, as we see needs at its best, we move towards ways to try to alleviate or work better. So that part of creating and of technology is an outgrowth of our calling. I mentioned this book. Here's Tim Challey's definition of technology. Technology is the creative activity of using tools to shape God's creation for practical purposes. Technology is the creative activity of using tools to shape God's creation for practical purposes. Now, the problem with that on this side of the fall, as we know, is that that which enables work can so easily become a controlling desire or even an idol for us. The work itself, which was created to be good, can itself become an idol. And technology just feeds into that. I think back to several years ago when I was with my family at the beach, and there we are enjoying being at the beach, playing on the beach, kids are playing, family off to the side, also enjoying playing and being at the beach. But, you know, 50 yards down, I see Dad walking down the beach with his BlackBerry. Now, it would now be an iPhone, probably. But what was going on there? Well, for whatever reason, somehow work came with Dad to the beach. Now, the best spin on that is, one of the ways technology frees us is that Dad could say, you know what, I have the freedom now on a not regularly scheduled vacation to go to the beach with you, and I can handle some business on the phone, and this allows me to be there. That's a great blessing. In other words, sometimes technology allows us freedom that actually helps our work life. Now, the flip side of that is now that work can come with you, work is going to be tempted to always come with you. It could have also been the Dad where this is their week vacation. They've been planning for months and Dad can't pull himself away from the office. And 20 years ago, if he went on vacation, he had no choice but to unplug. But now there's this thing pulling at him. We have a drive to do good work, whether that is in a career, whether that's in your schoolwork, whatever lines up with your passion that you're willing to spend yourself for. You know what it feels like on the good days to feel like I'm doing this gladly. This is work that I love to do. We were created for that. But in the midst of our drive to do, technology can often help that. And it can also help us sometimes idolize that and send it off course and off the rails. Think about for a minute about all the hoopla that comes up every number of months when the next version of a device comes out. Now, I'm not talking about going from shouting across the street to the iPhone. It's going from the iPhone 72 to the iPhone 73, right? And now they move the button from the right side to the left side. You know, you've seen the sort of commercials that mock it, but, you know, there's that sense where not only do I need technology, but, like, I need the latest and greatest and fastest thing. Somehow technology in the midst of even work hooks us like that. The fact that the next iPhone is a little bit faster, does that actually help you finish your work faster so that you then have more free time? If you own an iPhone 6, are you more liberated than the people that can still get their iPhone 1 to work? Or if anything, are we both blessed and cursed at the very same time? Both happen. Okay, so technology taps into our drive to do. You know, when I see my kids sit down and do a book report where they can then, you know, pull pictures from the web that map on to the book that they read, when they can format it and it looks great. Like, there's something about the toolness of it that's very helpful. Most of us have jobs likely that require using a computer. I'm using an iPad up here. Am I cool? Oh, wait, that's one of the later points. So, but it helps us do our work, but sometimes it traps us too. Okay, so it taps into this desire to do. Now, it also taps into our drive to rest. which is also a part of the way we were created to be. Now, as you know, the fourth commandment taps into this very call and drive from Exodus 20. Let me read a few verses. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you, your son, your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your livestock, the sojourner who's within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that's in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Whatever your personal convictions about what you can or can't do on a Sunday morning, you can at the very least hear this calling that God gives us to Sabbath, which just simply means to rest. And we're reminded here in Exodus that God rested on the seventh day after he created, which means rest is not simply an unfortunate side effect of being human. You know, maybe like me, you've had those thoughts sometimes of like, what if I could just like sleep 1 hour less at night? Think about all the things that I could get done. Or what if I could just tuck my family in bed and like just do stuff all night long? That would be purgatory on earth. I know we're Protestants and we don't believe in purgatory, but that would be a picture of it, working all the time. Why? Because we were created to actually rest. It's not just unfortunate. It's a part of the way God wired you. And so when you're mad that you get tired and your body doesn't do everything you want it to do and you can't just work around the clock or play around the clock or do whatever around the clock, you're kicking the goads against the way God's made you to be, because he's created us to rest and not just sleep. But rest in such a way, even when we're awake, that it is restorative for us. And that's part of the call here when he talks about the Sabbath day, a day to actually rest so that we restore ourselves. But think about the ways that technology taps into the ways we already try to avoid that. Imagine small children when, as parents, you come to them and say, it's time to have rest time. You've got to take a nap. And they cry as if like you had just, you know, you had told them that the world was ending. Like this is the worst possible thing to ever happen. When I got to college, I realized, wait a minute, I can take a nap every day. This is the greatest thing ever. But there is part of us, though, that resists, even though we know we need to rest, resists resting well. And yet we were created to rest well. And one of the ways that manifests is sometimes we choose entertainment over actual true rest and restoration. Now, that's not new to us. It certainly goes back. We could, you know, no doubt we could look back any number of years. Certainly we've all grown up now in a TV generation. But think about the ways in which the digital world now is able to customize our entertainment experience so that we can always have something feeding into us that is recreational, but at the end of the day is not restful. You know, every time you get on the web and search for something and some little computer records that somewhere, it even feeds us all the right ads that we want to see so that we can buy the right things and so we can numb ourselves a little bit more. Think about the simple revolution that's going on with the advent of Netflix. And I like Netflix. But suddenly, again, it used to be you had to get up at a certain, you know, be in front of your TV at a certain time to watch a show. Now you can watch 4 seasons of a show in like 48 hours straight with, again, no sleep. And what does it do to us? Certainly not only good things. That's not to say we have to turn away from all of those things, but it does mean as followers of Jesus and being human, we've got to be wise. Because we were created to rest. And so things like the digital world, like so much else in the world, taps into the fact we were created for that, and yet at the same time we resist that. And we don't want to be restored by God. We don't want to be quiet long enough to actually pray. We don't want to be quiet long enough for the unsettledness of our heart to begin to bubble up. Because after all day long, we've been trying to keep it under control and pushed down. And so now we need entertainment in our off hours to do the very same thing. But you see, we were created to rest. In the digital world, can be used for good in that, but like everything else that we create, can also come and bring us great harm. We are created to do. We're created to rest. Our drive to do, our drive to rest. Thirdly, our drive to know. 1 Kings chapter 4 speaks of God's gifting of Solomon with wisdom. Let me read several verses. God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure and breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and the wisdom of Egypt. He was far wiser than all other men, wiser than Ethan the Ezrahite, Heman Calcol, and Darda the sons of Mahol, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He also spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of the wall. He spoke also of beasts and birds and reptiles and fish. And the people of all nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon from the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. What's interesting about this is you get a picture of Solomon who notices the hearts of kings and the weed that's growing up in the sidewalk as he walks through town. He had this mind and this passion to like not only notice but to put things together to become, in fact, wise. Someone that took the data of the world and ran it through a grid of relationship with God and came up with and came to a deeper understanding of what it means to live wisely before our Creator. Now, what does the digital world do for this, for us? It helps enormously in understanding and grasping the data. I can remember in preparing for a sermon years ago when I called up a friend of mine, or I might have even emailed, we were at email at that stage. So I emailed him and said, where's that quote from C.S. Lewis about blah, blah, blah? And he wrote me back, he said, I don't know, Google it. And when I read that, I was like, of course, I should Google it. And so I did. Do you remember the time when Googling something wasn't just your automatic response? I mean, you don't have to explain to anybody to do that now. It's our first response for information when you're not near another source. My kids think it's great that I can pick up my phone and hit a button and speak out loud to it. You know, who won the World Series 4 years ago? And it's going to spit out the answer. My son, who loves sports, really loves this because his dad is no repository of sports data. So we need Siri and the Internet to provide that for us. But you think about kids right now as they're doing research papers in all areas of life. You know, when one of the things we thought about and your church thinks about and everybody does when we started Grace a few years ago is like, well, step one, we need to have at least a respectable looking website. Why? Because how do people find things now? They search on the Internet. We all do that. Again, it's become mythic. Of course you do that. You know, in the midst of our desire to know and the ways in which so much technology helps us know data and things, it also can help provide the false illusion that if I know data and things, or at least if I know how to get them, that's somehow all that I need. You know, the disconnected facts of trivia out there. For a kid in school to be able to simply access the data points and stick it into a paper and turn it in versus the next step, as Solomon did, of taking that data, all those inputs, and actually turning it into lived out wisdom. You see, the technology can be a help to us, but it can also be a hindrance because once we get the data, we're tempted to think that's all we need to do. In fact, data no longer even often serves the purpose of coming to a coherent decision about something. Data is enjoyed for its own purpose, for its own being. How many times have you scrolled through websites just reading things and glancing at things that weren't bad, but they're like, I'm not getting anything out of this that actually helps my life, and yet I just can't keep, you know, I can't stop scrolling. Like as if we need to know every little thing. When you can get on and you don't even have to go out to the end of your driveway to pick up the newspaper anymore. You can get on a website and find news from all over the world, data that you don't know what to do with. And that ultimately even just fries your brain and my brain. I mean, think about things that are happening on the other end of the world. Tragedies, for example, because that is what fuels so much of our news. Think about the ways in which maybe the sheer input of data is making our hearts more callous towards other people. There was an earthquake somewhere on the other side of the world, and X number of people died. Maybe you stop as a Christian and think, this is horrible, and you take a moment to pray for the people that have been affected. That's a great outcome. Maybe instead we look at the screen and we're like, oh, man, there's a sale at Target. You know, you just go on to the next bit of data. It all just becomes equal in our brains. Now, that the technology didn't invent that, but it helps exacerbate it. You know, better than the wisdom of Solomon, not only do we have Google, we have Wikipedia that speaks to every possible topic under the sun. You know, but that God-given desire and drive to know the world, to explore it, that's part of what God hardwired into us. And the digital world can be a helpful tool in that, or it can be an incredible distraction in that step of taking what God has done in this world and moving it towards wisdom. Now, the fourth point, I think, is maybe where most of us live in this most clearly day to day. And it's this. And, you know, so we talked about our drive to do and to rest, to know. And here, our drive to know and to be known. We were created to be relational beings. Genesis 1, verse 26. Then God said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness." Verse 27, so God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created it, male and female, he created them. Genesis 2:18, it is not good that the man should be alone. You hear what's built into the very fabric of creation. We are created not to simply be solo entities in the universe, but we are created to relate to others. We are created to relate to God, our creator. But one of the things that is just astounding about what Genesis tells us is that when God created Adam to be in relationship with him, what more could he want? Everything is perfect in the world, and yet he looks at Adam and says, there's one thing that's not good. It's not good for him to be alone. In other words, God said, I made you in such a way that it's not right to say, all I need is God. Now, that sounds wrong, doesn't it? Because part of us is, God's what I need most. Yes. And the God whom you need most also said we need other people. He created us that way. In other words, he created us to be in community. He created us to be in connection with each other. And so when you have a drive, I think especially of like kids growing up as they come into their own social worlds, when you have this drive to be with your friends and to be known by them, there's a lot that a kid has to learn about navigating friendships well and all that. But what are they responding to? A parent looks and says, now I've got to take my kid more places. You know, now it's become an incredible inconvenience. What is happening to my child? They're living out who God created them to be, relational beings in connection with other people. See, God made us to be that way. And so we will find and we will long for ways to connect with each other. And that, of course, is the power behind social media. It is just one more expression of the ways in which we try to connect with other human beings. Some of us remember what it's like to write a personal letter to someone and to receive one. This is probably changing too, but I can imagine the one small segment of American society that probably still gets a glimpse of that is like kids that go off to camp for the summer, unless they take their devices with them. You know, they're like, what is this strange piece of paper with writing on it that says mom and dad on it? You know, there's still some situations in which we reach out to each other on paper, but long before obviously the digital revolution or telephones or anything, it's part of our drive to connect with each other. And so we're going to take every technology that relates to communication and we're going to enfold that into our created drive to connect. Now, here's the thing about social media. Media comes from the word mediated. Media first meant that experience is mediated to us through something else. Okay, so if you and I sit down at coffee and have a conversation, then in one sense, that's an unmediated conversation. If we talk to each other on the phone, we're doing that through a media. We're talking from far apart. We can't see each other's facial expressions. You can't have the warmth of a touch. You still get the warmth of a voice. That's a change in relationship. Now let's take it one more degree. Let's say we're texting each other. Okay, now you've stripped away even the vocal intonation, and all you've got, 140 characters. And please don't use emoji. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Okay, sorry. Maybe you do. But or face, all those little pictures to communicate. Like that is a different way in which we communicate. It reduces, if nothing else, our communication to just a few lines. Now, that is super helpful when your spouse needs to remind you to pick up something from the grocery store and when you need to pass on some information. The problem is that sometimes that helpful tool can infiltrate the way we actually communicate with each other as human beings. All of our connections, unless they're face-to-face, are mediated. And the danger here is simply that we could fall into a disconnect from face to face. Imagine if you were somebody who was around for the advent of the telephone, when you realized, I've got to go have a hard conversation with somebody. Wait a minute, I don't have to go over to their house and knock on the door. I can call them on the phone. And that way I don't have to see the disappointment in their face. Right? Wait a minute, I need to have a hard conversation with somebody. I don't have to go over to their house. I don't even have to hear their voice. I can send them an email. And on it goes. How many of you have received an email that caused, because of what it is, its media as an email, that caused greater hurt than existed before it was even? Let me put it this way. Have you ever got an email and thought, well, what does he mean by that? Well, I mean, is he being sarcastic or was he being serious? Well, I don't hear his voice. I don't see his face. I've lost touch of the warmth of our conversation. You know, in some of the reading I did, it talks about just, with the generation that's becoming more and more connected digitally. And it's not just our kids, it's all of us. We are more and more perhaps in danger of losing the ability to really have face-to-face conversations. To really connect with other human beings. It's not that phones and text and email are evil, but are they having unintended or potentially have unintended consequences that we haven't considered? The truth is, in my own journey in this, I hate talking on the phone. And that's not because I want to talk face to face, it's because I want to text. There is that temptation to withdraw. Now, think about that in the context of something too, like Facebook. What are all the positives of Facebook? It allows us to stay connected and see pictures and conversations with people that we would not have connection with otherwise. Okay, it's not that they're my neighbor and I just don't want to talk to them. It's people from 20 years ago and we would have no way to be connected if it weren't for that. And yet, how is that changing the quality of our relationships? This total side note, you might not know this, but you should. Every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. before the first service, a group of elders gather to pray for the needs of the church and to pray for the services that morning. And it's really a beautiful time just to see those men caring for the church. But as I was with them today waiting for that to start, won't call you out by name. A couple of the elders were sitting there. He's like, look what I saw here on Facebook. And he shows him a video. And he's like, where did that come from? He said, I don't know. It got passed on from that. That's our connected life becoming unconnected. How many of you found yourself okay, quick poll. How many of you have a Facebook account? Mark Zuckerberg would look out here and say, there's some money to be made right in this room. Okay, for those of you that are, have you ever found yourself scrolling through that and just because you had 5 minutes? Or just because you're trying to wind down from the rest of the day? And part of your brain is saying, I'm staying connected with friends. But maybe some part of our experience is, I'm just becoming distracted by data that's unconnected from real relationship. None of this is to say that technology is evil. It is simply to say that technology is not neutral. Nothing we create is neutral. That there are always potential benefits as well as dangers that we have to walk through. And as we are engaged, again, so much in social media, for example, think about the temptations that underlie that. I can craft a new self. Maybe I have a tendency to put my foot in my mouth often in personal conversations, but with a little bit of reflection, I can just put the smart stuff on my status update. And I'm not sharing this time with you where you see everything, but I can share this one snapshot that makes me and everything else look good. We tend to gravitate towards all the things that we think speak well of ourselves. Now, that's a drive in us, and a twisted drive from what we were created to be as far as relating to each other in love. But Facebook didn't create that, but it gave us a new avenue to create even digitally a world for ourselves that is not the real flesh and blood world that we inhabit. Gives us possibly a false sense of knowing others. I read their status update. I know what's going on with them. Maybe in many of us, it cultivates the critic in us over the servant. Think about the times when you walk into a room and you think thoughts like, I can't believe he just said that. Or, really, that person's wearing that. Or, you know, the disease of our heart goes with us everywhere. But what happens when we're remotely scrolling through the lists upon lists of things our friends and others have shared? And there's no feedback for the growing criticism in our hearts and lives. When we can just become critics pronouncing judgment on everybody's lives as we flip through it. And as we said with the news before, maybe sometimes too, as we read through all that, it encourages sentimentality over love. We can like a photo. We can be sorry for something we just read that happened, and then we're on to the next thing in another 4 seconds or so. Okay. Four things that technology taps into. It's our desire, our drive to do, to rest, to know, and then to know and be known. Let me just wrap up with this. We are called as followers of Jesus when it comes to the digital world, our families, our life in this world, and our culture, to live wisely. And wisdom comes slowly and is often hard won. And it's not simply through surface interactions and absorbing of data, but actually taking life and running it through the grid of knowing Jesus and learning over time what it means to walk with him in a faithful way. And as much as the internet speeds up our life, let us not be naive and think that it is somehow speeding up our ability to acquire wisdom. And let us not hope merely for ourselves and our kids that they grow up to be people who are technologically savvy, or even that have the technological job skills for the upcoming market. What do we want for our kids and ourselves? To be people that know how to use the media around us well, to use technology and every tool well, walking in wisdom as we know our God. You know, I came across a number of just, you know, kind of those helpful points as you think about family, but maybe simply this, if you're thinking about this for yourself or for your family, maybe just some of this boils down to this one simple question. You know, how does this device or this technology help me and help my family? And in what ways is it going to hurt? Or in what ways are we going to trade off something? The family that's thinking, okay, do we get the family iPad? How's that going to change the way we relate as a family? Or do each of my kids need to have their own device? How's that going to change the way we relate? What opportunities does it open up? And what possibilities of life does it shut down? How will they create new patterns in the ways that we live? In other words, we need to question the mythic status of our technology. None of it always existed. None of it is inherent in the world that God made, but all of it is attempts to live in this world in an easier way, or what is good and what needs to be filtered. Maybe another one. In what ways does this technology open you up to God's purposes in your life? And in what ways does it undermine them? In what ways do you need to discipline yourself to use technology wisely and well rather than be controlled by it? I guess what I've been trying to do in some small way is to simply say, as with any of these topics for the lecture series this summer, God's call to his people is not to somehow withdraw from the world. It is God's world, and it is redeemable. What does he call us to do? To live wisely following him with our eyes open and sometimes asking questions that the world around us is not asking. You know, how are we going to be savvy and wise, and how are we going to keep our eyes on Jesus in the midst of these kind of technology and opportunities that we have? Now, this is this talk is not going to make you walk away going, today I had a bigger and more glorious picture of the beauty of Jesus. Hopefully that happens in first service and in second service. But I hope it does is maybe simply give you some questions, or at least we've stopped for 45 minutes to think, okay, let's step out of the river that's rushing past us and just look at it for a minute and try to figure out again what's good, what's harmful, how can we live, and how can we follow God wisely in this world. Let's pray. God, we thank you. We thank you that you, your sovereign hand is over everything, that you created us for such beautiful things as to mimic and mirror you as a creator. You're a creator with a big C, and we are creators with small C's. You call us to work well and to further your purposes in this world. Lord, you've created us to know. You've given us a thirst to understand this world and respond wisely to it. You've given us a need to rest that we might be restored and not simply entertained. You've given us the desire to know and be known because you've made us to be relational. You've made us to stand in relationship with you and others. So, Father, in the ways that the topics we've been talking about this morning fit along those purposes, help us to celebrate them. And the ways in which they challenge or move against those created purposes help us to be wise and not be drawn in. And we pray that in all things in this world, you would be honored. And we pray it in the name of Jesus. Amen.